Well, thank you for organizing this workshop and inviting me. I want to apologize in advance because due to the nature of this meeting, I didn't want to talk about all what I do or my work. I wanted to address specific things that are of relevance, maybe show some examples. So this talk is put together from many other talks, and some notational glitches might appear. So variables may not be consistently the same throughout the talk. So where I can, I'll point that out. It shouldn't be a problem. Anyway, the title was the title of a paper that I wrote with Rob Crittenden and Gongbo Zhao a long time, like almost 10 years ago. And it was a paper about how to reconstruct unknown functions from cosmological data. And Rob is a fan of REM, so he, it's a rock band.
So they have one of these, or
they have an album called Fables of Reconstruction. Yeah, so it's named after an album, but it also fits our topic.
Fables of Reconstruction.
There is maybe an article missing. Yeah, but Anyway, let's stop wasting time. So suppose you have some function, like a common function cosmologists want to learn about is the equation of state of dark energy. And suppose that somehow the universe in which we live has a dark energy with this kind of an equation of state. Suppose there is...
There's a notation problem already. You should have x from what you told us.
No, x was different.
I know, but you really want x.
Yeah, as I said, this was before x.
Yeah.
And there's...
He's a cosmologist, then it's a cosmologist.
Just because you have a favorite model, it doesn't mean W is a bad function. It's fine to look...
I think W is a bad function independent of whether you have a favorite model.
But tell that to all the observers. Okay.
That's
okay, so suppose this is the true function and you want to learn about it using observation. So one naive approach would be to bin that function in redshifts, discretize it, discretize your redshift, and take the value of W in each redshift bin as a parameter, and feed that to data. Right? So if you assume that each parameter, each W, is independent in every bin, and feed that, what you'll find is that there is a lot of degeneracy between these W's. So because what we observe is always an integral along the line of sight, and when you integrate, you can compensate with W being up in one bin, with the W being down in another bin, and essentially there is no information about redshift dependence of these W's. So that would, for you, would be manifested in having very large error bars on your W's. On the other hand, since you did not assume anything about W, if you use sufficiently large number of bins, you will not bias the reconstruction. So you would get big error bars, but at least theoretically, the mean value should be the same as this. So there is no bias, at least in principle. In practice, your MCMC would probably not even converge because you would have too many parameters with lots of degeneracy, so you would not get this in a finite amount of time, but if you did, you would not have bias.
Sorry, I think that's the main point. You're saying that the bins have to be small enough, they shouldn't be too big, is that?
So suppose function has a particular feature of a certain size scale in redshift. So as long as you have more bins than typical size of that feature, you shouldn't bias the reconstruction. Now, that's the idea. But as soon as you have more than a few bins, you lose your ability to constrain them because your observations are highly insensitive to bins at different redshifts, right? So if you have no prior, the conclusion is no prior means no bias, but large variance in your reconstruction. So the idea was the Fables paper, was to reconstruct by adding a prior on the space of bins that would correlate the values of W at different redshifts. So you would add a prior, and I'll elaborate on the math that goes into this later, but the idea is to add a prior that now correlates the bins. And now, if you add that prior, what you find is that if your prior is very strong, if it forces the bins to be highly correlated with each other, in the limit of ultra-high correlation, you reproduce a constant W that just makes the function very stiff. So if you're close to that limit of ultra-high correlation, you would, instead of that, reconstruct something like that. You would not be able to see the wiggle. On the other hand, you would have tiny error bars because correlation would force the spread to be small. So you would have small errors or small variance, but large bias. You would bias the outcome. Bias being the difference between what the sky has and what you get out of it. The difference between true and reconstructed. So what you want is a reasonable prior such that when you use it, you get a reconstructed function which has variance of a similar order to bias, so that whatever bias you get is not significant compared to the error bars. So that's,
To decide on this, you kind of have to have an expectation, right? I mean, that's the part that I find.
Expectation for what?
For what the form of W should be, right? I mean,
yes.
It just seems really, I mean.
Yeah, so this is in the absence of a theory.
In the absence of a theory, if you're...
Where I'm going is that ideally, when this becomes meaningful is when you do have an expectation for W.
Yeah.
And that expectation could come in the form of correlation functions that are specific to particular classes of theories. You could have the correlation between W at different bins, but also the mean value of W. So that is a less important piece of information, what the mean is, mean at each bin. But as long as you have the correlation, you can do reconstruction, and that you can get from theories. So I'll get there, okay? So at this point, if you did not have any theory, at least you could help have a prior so that at least you know that whatever bias you get. So whether you have bias or not depends on the kind of behavior you could have in the function. That's true. So you need a theory. So what's a reasonable prior? Ideally, it should be informed by a theory, and I've done some work which is more recent than this paper, in which we derived priors from broad classes of scalar tensor theories, like Hornsky theories and subclasses of Hornsky. But the idea is that smooth features, once you apply this prior, the basic principle of this approach is that smooth features, which data can constrain well, they are not biased by the prior. They're sort of prior independent. But noisy features, they are determined by the prior. So the prior acts as a noise suppressant. So this become more clear as I move on.
So smooth features are not biased, but noisy features are determined by.
Yes. So data cannot constrain high frequency features in W. So if W does this, data has no way of constraining that. But on the other hand.
If W from the theory does this, then data cannot constrain it. Is that what you're saying?
So
I'm just trying to figure out.
If W really did that, the observations
wouldn't pick it up. That's what you mean.
You would get a large statistical error bar on that. Yes.
Right. So you wouldn't know that such features exist at all from the data.
Yeah. So
if you had a theory which did predict those kinds of fluctuations,
It depends. So if these fluctuations are, so that's, it's a quantitative question. So how, what is the high frequency as far as the observations are concerned? So that that's determined by the redshift width of your tomographic redshift bins. Now, fortunately, where observational cosmology is heading now is that that redshift width is going to be determined by people who analyze the data. In other words, you get a 3D tomographic scan of all the large-scale structure. That's eventually that's what we're going to get. And how you slice it in redshift is a matter of practical convenience. So observers, in the absence of necessity, if you just want to learn about lambda CDM, you really don't need a lot of resolution, right? So they would just put, like, say, 10 bins, and that's what you get in their white papers.
The data is collected, and you can just decide.
Yeah, but the data, at least in principle, the survey gives you three numbers, angular coordinates and redshift. And the precision in redshift is going to be extremely high, much higher than you need for most of the models. Of course, there is a cutoff, and you have less galaxies per bin if you, but ultimately with things like Euclid, LSST, maybe with some 21 centimeter surveys where the redshift is in principle known already by, it defines your, like distance is defined by redshift in 21 centimeters. Anyway, so, in some sense, you could say what resolution I need from your from my theory to test it, right? Smooth means correlated. So you want a smooth. So the starting point is a correlation function, and when I use W, it doesn't have to be W. Think of W as a representative example. It could be any other function. You start with a correlation, and correlation function written in this form assumes that there is some fiducial function. So you look at correlation in a departures of your function from a fiducial, let's say minus one. Let's say fiducial is minus one. And then you can make a choice for the functional form. A functional form would be such that for small separation in redshift or scale factor, you have significant correlation, but as you take delta to be widely separated, it goes to zero. We chose this function based on practical convenience because we could integrate this exactly analytically. But you, if you're writing a computer code, you don't care. You could use any other form. Later on, when my friends and I did simulations to determine this correlation in quintessence models in scalar tensor, surprisingly, it turned out to be a very good fit to quintessence models, this functional form. And we could actually measure what these parameters should be. So AC sets the correlation length, and this sets the overall strength of the prior. So we also tried different functional forms. So we concluded that exact functional dependence is not crucial. In other words, it really depends on what the parameters AC and this overall strength is. So we didn't try delta A squared. We tried exponent of minus modulus delta A.
Okay, I see.
What does it mean?
And what's the random aspect here? You're talking about the correlation between the value of, what is this delta exactly?
Delta A?
What are the variations?
Delta A or delta W?
Delta W. If you go back to
This is exactly what you were writing over there.
This is what I'm writing over here, but here we have a stochastic.
Yeah.
Is there something stochastic? Are you assuming that there's something stochastic in the model?
Theory space, right?
What is this bracket? What are these angle brackets represent? What ensemble?
It's the It's the ensemble of your unknown parameters.
So it's the.
It's a realization. It's a realization of that function in your universe. Suppose you have an unknown function, which represents a certain theory, but a particular realization of that function. Let's say you have quintessence. That function would depend on the form of the potential, on the initial conditions, you don't know that a priori, but you could expect that once you have a particular set of initial conditions and the chosen potential, values of that function would be correlated at neighboring redshifts.
Once you have a particular initial condition.
So if you don't know your theory,
exactly what's about.
Yeah, if you did, but it's the ensemble. You could think of it as
the ensemble is the choice of different initial conditions.
For example, and different potentials.
Different potentials.
Yes.
So it's in theory space, right?
Ensemble in theory space.
In space, theory space.
Yeah. But in practice, you are both doing the same thing. I mean, you may just think, Drahwa has a stochastic process in mind. You're thinking about the prior in a space of models. But in practice, basically, there is some function that you don't know, and you quantify it by some probability function.
But yes, but it's meant to be a theoretical prior. It's meant to be ensemble of your theories.
That's true.
Solutions, ensembles of solutions. So, once you have your function, you can now project that onto covariance or correlation of the beans of W. So W is the discrete. Wi and J are discretized versions, and the way you do it is by essentially integrating this over the widths of the beans. And you get the discrete version. So this would be now the covariance on the space of the beans. And once you have that covariance, you can build a Gaussian prior distribution. So this would be a prior Gaussian prior probability density, which you define in terms of this prior chi-square, where C now is this matrix that you build. Is that clear? So once you have your prior, prior covariance, you actually can study and understand it. So one way to understand it is to look at eigenmodes. So look, diagonalize your covariance matrix, the prior covariance, and see what are the best constraint and worst constraint eigenmodes. In other words, W of A. What forms of W of A are best constraint and worst constraint? So you find that if you order them in 1 over sigma squared, where sigma is a statistical, is the variance.
Data here or not?
No data. It's pure prior. So you can just, it helps to understand your prior. Understand what modes of the prior are best constraint and worst constraint. So you do the principal component analysis, and you find linear combinations of the beans, which are best constraint and worst constraint. Anyway, it's.
But this should be just Fourier transform the correlation function, shouldn't it?
No. Fourier.
The modes are. I mean, as long as it is a short term, the modes are just Fourier modes. Independent modes are just Fourier modes, and then the power spectrum would be just the variance.
The Fourier modes are the basis of that you choose on solutions of Laplace operator. So Fourier modes are a particular basis in which you choose to.
If you have translation in variance.
Yeah, but here the basis functions are the eigenfunctions of your covariance.
Right.
So it's just a different basis, but yes, the idea is similar.
Yeah. So I guess this AC there, that's what makes
sense. So you get that, for example, this prior is mostly is sensitive to high frequency oscillations and least sensitive to overall constant W, for example. Let me move on, and then we kind of, in my talk, you come back to similar things several times. So So what you eventually have is a prior that you could add to your likelihood. So you use the Bayesian approach to determining the probability of your W parameters given the data. So that would be your posterior. And the posterior, according to Bayesian approach, is the product of data given your W times the probability of a particular model for W. So you know this, and now you can, I mean, this is just a cartoon to where we assume that everything is Gaussian. Yeah.
Just to make sure I understand, so this posterior is not yet normalized to be, I mean, it can be used to compare one model with another or one set of parameters with another. It's not a probability as such in the sense that if you integrate it over W.
In this case, I didn't normalize. Yeah. I didn't normalize it. I should have written as a proportionality.
Okay.
Usually it is as a proportionality and you normalize it.
Because you're just looking for the maximum. In reality, you look for the combination of W's that give you a maximum.
It seems to me that this P of W observed, this first factor on the right-hand side, cannot be normalized in any natural way. I mean, it has an arbitrary normalization. In practice, it's only defined up to an overall normal.
Yes, in practice, you're looking for the minimum of chi-square.
No, that's too practical. I don't mean to.
And that sets the maximum of that.
I mean, the prior is something you impose, so it is normalized. You can impose it to me. But this the probability of W observed, it depends on the bin size. It depends on, not your bins, but You don't observe an exact W, right?
Yes.
A little.
W here is, again, this is a cartoon, but what I mean by W observe is obviously some observable, which is a function of.
No, I understand. But that observable is usually a number.
Yes.
And the probability of getting exactly that number is zero.
Yeah.
You really can only ask the probability of getting it in a little interval. And then the answer will depend, be proportional to the size of the interval. That's what I mean by saying there's no real normalization for that conditional probability.
You're saying basically some measure that you have to put on the space and
then. I think you always measure things with finite number of digits, and that has a finite probability. And you could do all of that properly. And it doesn't enter anywhere, basically, because it just...
Yeah, I don't think that affects anything, because in practice, you eventually look for the maximum of the posterior distribution. You want to find the best parameter.
But, I mean, if you just write that formula down, it won't be normalized, right? You have to do the integral.
Yes.
And divide it through by...
Absolutely.
Okay, yes. That's all I...
Yes. I'm sorry, I'm not rigorous enough for mathematical audience.
Just to understand that first term a little bit.
Yeah.
So this is that given a W, what is the probability that you would get this observation? Is it?
That's this factor. Yeah.
That is, so given, suppose your theory, suppose it was actually W, how probable is it to get? So if you have a really bad theory that doesn't match, then this would be a very low probability.
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry, a very dumb question.
You should ask, definitely.
Just to understand the whole framework better.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah, and so this is something that CosmoMC gives. It has all the likelihoods of, like F here, it stands for Fisher matrix, which is the inverse of the covariance. But this is something you get by fitting to data. In here, I assume that it's known, but it's not easy to get. You actually have to do the fit to get it. So it's not available, but for what I'm going to do, you can think of it as a forecast, if you wish. So prior is also Gaussian, as I explained. This we can just, for the sake of current argument, assume to be Gaussian. And then you look for the maximum of the posterior. So you plug this to in there and take a derivative with respect to W and set it to zero to determine maximum of the posterior. And you get an equation that tells you what the best fit should be. Yeah? The best fit, or W reconstructed, is the solution that gives you the maximum of the posterior. Right?
Can you repeat that? Sorry.
So take these two things are Gaussians. You substitute it into the top equation, and then find the maximum or extrema, an extremum, take a derivative of the top equation with respect to w and set it to zero. That tells you at what w gives you the extremum of that function. That's this. So extremum of that function is would be, I call it w reconstructed. I could have called it best fit, or w that gives to the extremum. So that's it. It's just, and then I could manipulate this equation in, like, using rules of linear algebra and write it like that. Just w reconstructed. So this assumes that I somehow know f, which I could, if it's a forecast, I could, given in my experiment, I could forecast the Fisher matrix. And this is just to point out that it has two terms, which one acts essentially as a high pass filter of the fiducial w. So allows high frequency fluctuations of your fiducial. But fiducial doesn't have any high frequency fluctuations. And it acts as a low pass filter for the observed. So it suppresses high frequency modes. That's maybe not obvious from this equation at all, but you could interpret it like that. We used it for understanding our work. But this is going back to principal components.
So this depends on your choices of C and F.
C is your prior, yeah. And F is determined by your experiment.
So I mean, whether which one is high pass and which one is low pass depends on.
Well, the experiment is always, experiment always dominates the low pass,
right.
And prior dominates the high pass. So these are,
Can you go back?
Yeah.
So the only difference between these two is one has F inverse in front and one has C inverse.
Yeah.
And do you think that makes the difference between being high pass and low pass filter?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we can also use this so-called principal component analysis to understand what our prior does. So these are eigenvalues of the prior, and these are the eigenvalues of the data, so Fisher matrix. So how do you interpret that? So eigenvalues tell you the errors, uncertainty, in independent linear combinations of your bins. So bins, let's say you have 100 bins. You cannot constrain 100 numbers, but you can constrain some linear combinations of them well, and in a way that they are independent, statistically independent of each other. And then you can ask, what are the error bars on this well-constrained independent combinations of W? And you find that three of them would be constrained independently of the prior. So these are the inverse sigma squared of eigenvalues of prior, and this is data. So as you go to higher mode numbers, so as high frequency features, when you look at data, they get larger and larger error bars. So one over sigma squared becomes smaller and smaller as you go to higher and higher frequency eigenmodes. But for the prior, it's the opposite. And then you can also look at the eigenmodes of the posterior, which is data plus prior, and it does that. And you, by examining this, you find that there are three, in this particular case, for example, there are three, maybe three and a half modes, which would be constrained independent of the prior. So prior did not bias the reconstruction of certain features of certain frequency. So let me illustrate this more again here. So these are the shapes. So these are the different eigenmodes. This is the best constrained eigenmode, second best constrained eigenmode, third best, and fourth best.
So for doing this, you have used the other analysis, right? I mean, the other way of finding the best fit, the reconstruction.
I used a forecast. So I, instead of actually using real data, I take parameters of a given survey, and I can predict to what accuracy it can constrain W.
Okay, but
and that gives me F.
But For the eigenmodes, you're doing this. Each eigenmode, you're doing this separately.
I diagonalize my I diagonalize F and C, and also F plus C. And I find that tells me the independent linear combinations of my W bins that are best constrained. And I can arrange them in the order in redshift and plot them as function of redshift. And I get this. So this, for example, if W as a function of redshift did this, or scale factor, that feature would be very well constrained. If it did this, it would be second best constraint, et cetera. And you see that this is data plus prior, meaning when you both are used, and data are very similar. So they correspond to this top three where they're not biased. So what you learn from this is when you try to do your reconstruction, this tells you up to which frequency you can trust your reconstruction. After which frequency your reconstruction is dominated by the prior. Yeah. So in this particular case, we could tell in advance.
It's not dominant. Up to which, for the low frequencies, you want not to be dominated.
No, for the low frequency, not to be dominated. Not to be dominated. Yes.
I thought you said dominated.
Not dominated.
Not dominated.
Thank you. Yeah. So we want to know. So there's features in W. We want to know which features we can trust, and that if we measure some, and which we cannot. So this tells you where the threshold lies. If we see some low frequency feature, if it has a higher frequency than any of this, then we trust it. If it's lower, we know that that's dependent on our prior.
So one thing I'm a bit puzzled by is I understand this comparison between data and prior for every mode, but I don't understand how you can compare the errors of different modes.
Errors on different
modes? On different modes, because I mean they have different shapes. So how do you know? How would you say error in? Yeah, so I don't understand.
That's a good point. The comparison becomes difficult when you go to higher frequency modes, but at least for the first few, the shapes. So it happens that the first few of the total and data coincide. So that, and then after that, it gets more difficult.
But I'm saying, you have like this mode, and then you have this mode.
Mm-hmm.
So you can. How do you say, error of this is bigger than error of this because they're different.
Here we ordered modes according to frequency. So they're ordered according to frequency, not according to eigenvalues.
Some average frequency or something.
It's not an easy thing to do to find that ordering. Sometimes it's impossible. Because for the reason Nyash picked on, that the shapes are different and it's difficult. But at least for the first few, as long as they are modes that are dominated by the information from the data, they'll dominate the posterior. And at least for them, you can see how many modes of data have a corresponding mode in data plus prior. Okay? And at some point, you fail to find one. And that's what you have. So you could test, for example, by putting some functions in, hiding it in the data, and trying to reconstruct using blind analysis. That's what we did. That was back quite some time ago. So we had some confidence. And then we went on in 2012 and used some combination of data which probed only the background, no perturbations. So we don't have to think about modeling perturbations. And reconstructed, and we saw this kind of reconstructions where the bands, the blue bands are 1 and 2 sigma regions. There are two different priors. One is stronger than the other. So it's what we call standard is slightly stronger prior than the weak prior. And the middle yellow line is the best fit. And the errors around the yellow line are the forecasted errors that you would get from a future survey like Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument, DESI. So the point was that today, the errors are big, but if nature wanted W to do this, DESI would measure it with this accuracy. So that's the point.
What are those numbers, 2.3 sigma? 2.5.
They are the improvements in chi-square. So so if your model gives a better improves chi-square, then from the delta chi-square, you can convert that into sigma.
How many parameters?
That number doesn't take into account.
Yeah.
It's a total chi-square.
Right.
So we do that separately.
Okay. Uh-huh. So you also vary over the priors, right? That's important.
Not here yet. So here this is for two fixed priors.
But for a given prior, you get one best chi-square fit, right?
Yes.
So.
And for a different prior, I get a different.
Different one. So
yeah.
The question is.
Exactly.
Optimize over the.
So.
Yeah.
No, we don't. So that's the principal difference between our approach and the Gaussian process, as often used. Gaussian process uses your prior parameters as part of the fit parameters. They optimize in some sense. That makes it un-Bayesian. It eliminates the meaning of the prior as something that should come from theory. In our approach, prior should come from theory. And it's not something you're allowed to vary. It's supposed to be fixed. So on the other hand, if you don't have a theory, and you still want to play with this, you could ask, to what extent my conclusions depend on the prior? And that's what we've done before we found the theoretical priors. So in this work, we wanted to examine Bayesian evidence for this reconstructed model of W and try different priors and see how Bayesian evidence changes as you change the prior. And that gives you a sense of how prior dependent your results are. Now,
even in the model, so the model doesn't really, so the model is something that predicts the particular form of W. But for it to give you a prior, to understand it, the prior is not actually coming directly from the model, is it? It's not something that's part of the dynamics, but it's something in that the form of the prior is something you assume.
Yes.
The way in which,
you can, in this case, we assumed in what I showed earlier, but you can derive priors from theories.
Oh, I see.
So Bayesian evidence is the integral of your posterior over the volume of all parameters. So here, prior is normalized. And because it's a number less than one, adding more dimensions makes this number smaller. So the prior P is normalized to one. So the more dimensions you have, the more chances are you may improve this function, so these functions may become more pronounced and sharply peaked about some choice and increase its value. But as a rule, more parameters just increase the volume over which this is less than one. So it reduces your total integral.
So
it smears out.
So it gets smaller everywhere to integrate.
But I guess in the limit when P is completely independent on your parameter, you just add a completely irrelevant parameter, which is flat, but it still integrates to one, then maybe it doesn't matter. At least that's my.
The way I put it is this is kind of a fraction
maybe
of
it does,
the volume of the parameter space that fits the data. If you think that P is 1 when you fit the data and 0 when you don't fit the data roughly, then the fraction of the volume of the parameters that fits the data is that, right?
So yeah.
That clearly means 1.
It's fraction of the parameter space that fits the data.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
If you increase the total, it's less than 1 and it dilutes it. I take back what I said. I take back what I said about adding irrelevant parameters. They make it less. Because it's an n-dimensional surface. And you have to normalize to n-dimensional surface or n-dimensional volume as opposed to. So,
so think about that little p, that's your likelihood. So if you say, so that's the probability that the amount of a given parameters fits the data, right? That's your likelihood. Okay.
I don't have to. I see curly p as a function of data and.
It's the data given. Parameters. It's the likelihood. It's what you would call the likelihood.
So I'm saying, think about it. If it's one, if your parameters exactly predict the data, and if your parameters give you something completely off, then it would be zero. So if you think about it in that terms, then this what we see is the fraction, but E is the fraction of the volume of the parameter space that fits the data.
If you measure volume with respect to the prior.
Yes. Yeah.
It's not some.
That p prior is kind of a measure in the space of.
Use that the measure.
Yeah, that's your measure.
Yes.
So just
but then.
Okay. So one more question about the prior. The form of the prior, of course, then is theory dependent, right?
Yes.
Functional form.
Yes.
So is that something that. So you said the prior should come from the theory. So
yes.
Obviously, the functional form of the prior would come from the theory. But so that's something that you input depending on what theory you have.
Yes. So this case,
on your
different theories, different classes of theories would be give you different outcomes of the fits because they would be based on different priors.
Okay. So therefore, it is a function of. So, in other words, that
and the number of parameters
there is for a particular theory.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Fine.
So this is what I was harping on that other question originally. So it seems to me that this E has an unknown normalization for this because this curly P of D conditioned on P has an unknown normalization, and you could take the ratios of two of them, and then that would be meaningful. Does E itself have a meaning, or does it?
We always take the ratio to another. We always take ratio to compare.
Okay. I think it has a meaning. If you're thinking about discrete numbers, I think if you're thinking about continuous numbers, then it becomes harder to define. But I think it's like I said, it's just a fraction of the space of the parameters that fits the data.
Yeah.
It might be a very small fraction if you have very good data, but still, I think it's that.
Let me keep going. So so the idea is that, I don't need to state the first two points, right? We have more parameters, so we want to compare, let's say, lambda CDM to this and judge whether this is a better model or not. And one way to do it is to look at the ratio of evidences. And one point I want to make is that even though with bin W in many bins, let's say it could be 100 bins. In our approach, really, n is unlimited. But because only, let's say, three eigenmodes of the data, only three linear combinations of these bins are really determined by the data, and the rest is determined by your theory, they cannot be considered free parameters. So this theory actually doesn't have 100 free parameters, even though you may use 100 bins. It only has three free parameters because that's the only three degrees of freedom that your prior allowed to vary. Okay? So in that sense, it's important to keep in mind. It may seem like a very flexible model, but the effective number of degrees of freedom is smaller. And we don't have to tell the evidence about that. That's built in into this. But so evidence is not going to be negligibly small just because we went from 100 bins to 1,000 bins. Okay, the effective number of constrained degrees of freedom will still be 3. Okay, so that's one of the nice things about this method is that completely independent of how many bins you choose. It has to be a large enough number, but it doesn't the results don't depend on the number of bins. So we look now at the ratio of evidences, and the way we control, and this is, here we actually look at different priors and look how does the evidence change as you vary the strength of the prior. And the way we do it is by changing the width of the bin, the width of, in which the value of W can vary. Let's say between minus 5 and 5. W for lambda is minus 1. Let's say we each bin is allowed to vary between minus 5 and 5, for example. And that's what sigma would be. And so we start with sigma being 0, which is the lambda CDM limit. In that limit, lambda CDM and our model are identical. So the evidence ratio should be 1. And that's what we have. Right? So at 0, they have the same delta logarithm. So this is the rate. It's the delta logarithm, which is the same as logarithm of the ratio. So it should be 0 for 0 sigma. And then if evidence for our model is bigger, the logarithm difference should be positive. And if it's less, it should be negative. So we find as we start from 0 and allow more flexibility to our model, the evidence goes up a little bit. But then when the volume of the parameter space becomes too big, it eventually goes negative. And the important thing to take out of this is that evidence is not very, there is this gradation ratios, of bias factors. So I forgot the exact assignment of what is significant and very, very significant, convincing, et cetera. But you have to be bigger than 1 at least to consider that this value here should be larger than 1 for your model to be preferred. So we are consistently small. And it does vary significantly with the strength of the prior. So what we conclude is that this dynamics that we see in W is not statistically significant in the Bayesian sense because it depends strongly on the prior, because evidence for it changes a lot with the prior. What you'd like to see instead, this is the future. So if we used an instrument like DESI and put the same W, that best fit W that we got, then as we relaxed the prior, the Bayesian bias ratio would be strong and not depend much. It would approach a constant and stay there. And so that would be a criterion for saying, we are convinced we detected dynamics. It's your Bayesian ratio is independent of the strength of the
prior. So everything goes to the maximum, but there's delta log.
It's for some particular choice of prior strength. Like if you relax your model a little bit.
No, I'm just like if the first one.
The first goes to, this.
No, the black.
The black.
The evidence.
I think it's 1 point something. 1.2 or something.
So it's like barely worth mentioning.
Yeah, it's that's why I'm just illustrating the method. I mean, you can tell from
the technical name for it.
You can tell from the plots that it's not a statistically significant result, right? But if you looked at this model, which you would, it's if you look at these error bars expected from DESI, it wouldn't matter what the prior is because the data is so good. So that's the point. So in our case, we still rely a lot on the prior to constrain these noisy modes. But future data will not depend on the prior as much.
I don't fully understand that graph there.
Yeah?
The red and the blue curves are what?
So your evidence
yes.
Depends on the likelihood.
Yes.
And it depends on the volume of the parameter space. So here we plot the improvement in the likelihood.
Okay.
And we plot the change in the volume. So you can see that it's a monotonic function. As you add more freedom to your model, the volume keeps increasing.
Yeah.
And likelihood also increases. So you improve the fit But at some point, adding more flexibility doesn't improve the fit, but the volume is increasing and evidence goes down.
Yeah, I heard the words, but I didn't correlate it.
Okay. But in the future, if it was the same W, you would relax, but the evidence would stay constant. Because so that's one criteria you can use. So we did the same analysis, or similar analysis, in 2016, because a lot more data was available then. And we got this reconstruction. And this is what 2012 result is, just superimposed. So if you want to compare 16 with 12, so this is the one sigma band of that reconstruction. And this is in 2016. And the main difference was this Lyman alpha thing at high redshift, which helped to push that down. And this is how it looks depending on what data sets you include. So,
how do you write it in terms of W? Because Lyman alpha, I think it's.
There is no data point here.
Oh, so what is
it? This is the. This is the. If you took this model, yeah? And this model had another bin, which went from this to redshift 1000.
Right.
If that's the best fit of that bin.
Oh, okay. I see.
Okay? So it just completes that model.
Oh, I see.
Yeah? So this is the best fit from 2012, but binned in one broad redshift. So this is how it looks. You can see, for example, you start with like Planck. It's CMB plus supernovae. You get that. And then you add a BAO in three topographic bins, in three slices in redshift. And you see the BAO create a feature. If you do in 9, which was also available, so it's sort of a choice. It's like, as I said, sometimes it's just the observer's or interpreter's choice to work with 3 or 9. If you do 9, you get that. If you add the reset all each node, you get something, etc. So OHD, I think it stands for observational Hubble data, but it's a direct measurement of expansion rate through observation of ages of galaxies. So imagine you have a galaxy in which, based on a chemical analysis of the stars, you can actually know the age of the star in years. And if you then look at galaxies at different redshifts, and you know their age, you could construct a redshift versus time function. So once you know Z as a function of T, you know A as a function of T, and you can get Hubble as a function of Z or whatever. So anyway, that's what this data is. And this is Lyman alpha. You see it pushes it down. Etc. So when you combine everything, you get that, and you can see that this OHD, this is the difference in chi-square, so BAO contributes significantly to reduce it, H-naught, Lyman alpha, OHD. So you can see which data set contributes to improving the chi-square. And this is another way of plotting this. So this is in Lambda CDM. What you can plot is the H as a function of Z renormalized by the best fit H as a function. If you fit Lambda CDM, you get a model for H of A. And then you can plot all the data, like H as measured by BAO, H as measured by OHD, H as measured by Lyman alpha, rescaled by the best fit model. So they want the data points ideally would be all aligned on one if they were consistent with Lambda CDM. And this is the error bar in the model. So you see there is a spread, and this is the H naught tension. And this is the Lyman alpha tension. You could do the same. Some of this data can be projected into angular diameter distance as well.
So you're not actually solving the tension.
On the left is Lambda CDM. On the right is the same thing, but now we renormalize to the model which we reconstructed. So here we renormalize to Lambda CDM. Here is H divided by the best fit H in our model. So that increases the spread because now we have a broader spread in our uncertainty about H, but it now brings the measurement closer to the one sigma and this as well.
What's the Lyman alpha tension?
It went down to below 2 sigma now. It used to be, at this point, it was more like 2.5, and they reanalyzed it. It's better now. Worse for you,
yeah.
Better for them.
In what redshift does it belong to?
2.2, 2.3, something.
So why is it worse for lambda?
It's not necessarily worse.
It makes it more consistent with lambda CDM.
It has a potential, but it's still a sort of small z. Well, 2 is getting,
yeah.
I don't know.
And this is the ratio of evidences in that case, same plot as I showed you before. Evidence is...
which one is the Lyman alpha is agreeing is 2 sigma off from what? From the local one? Oh, from lambda CDM.
It's 2 sigma off from the prediction of lambda CDM.
But is it... That means it's how is it compared to the supernova?
It's at a different redshift.
You cannot directly compare that.
Comparing when you talk about the Hubble tension.
No,
you don't.
So this is Hubble at all redshifts. So here Hubble is not a constant but a function of redshift.
Yeah.
And you can see how to what extent different data are in agreement with the prediction of lambda CDM. So H naught is disagreeing, but that's the measurement at redshift 0.
Like
the Lyman alpha is a...
If you took lambda CDM as your theory and you used the Lyman alpha and you extrapolate it to now, is it the high or the low? You know, which H naught is it close to?
It would... if you didn't have any other data, I think and you assumed lambda CDM, it would predict an even lower H naught.
Even lower?
Yeah.
I think it's very hard to do.
It's
a meaningful exercise.
Well,
everything is degenerate with everything.
So it was meta-dominated people.
I mean, you have negative dark energy density if you take the best bit from just to Lyman alpha.
Okay.
So I don't know.
But at that time, yeah, it's below. It's if you assume something about omega meta, I guess.
Yeah.
When people say there's a tension between the local and the whatever high redshift H naught, isn't that what they're talking about? They're taking lambda CDM, and they're saying what would be the value of H naught?
Yes.
According to this data set and according to this data set.
No, but the point is the CMB is
okay.
Very, because it's so precise and powerful, it can constrain all the parameters simultaneously. Nothing else can do that. So you cannot directly compare H naught today with anything else. But CMB is the only thing you can because it constrains everything simultaneously. Anything else like lambda alpha at redshift 3, because everything is degenerate and everything, you cannot just...
It makes no prediction by itself.
Right. Because there is omega matter, and then there is... the history of dark energy would be completely free, so I guess... So anyway, sorry to interrupt you. Do you want to take a break now, or let's see how far...
What is this other seminar that we were...
That's in 1 hour.
That's at 3:30, yeah.
That's at 3:30.
Yeah, so I guess the idea was to take a break now for like 10 minutes, and I was told they're not going to bring up the food, so I don't know, I guess we have to go downstairs to get it. So we can take a break for like 5 or 10 minutes, but I mean, it's up to us when we want to do it, and we can come back for a discussion.
But you're not finished yet,
No, I'm not finished.
Okay, so why don't you go ahead.
I can go a bit faster, so this is...
Let us know when you think is a good place to pass on. Continue. Go ahead.
Okay, so in this other reanalysis, we also analyzed evidence. The bottom line is evidence increased. So it's kind of interesting. You got more data, more accurate data, and the evidence increased. This plot is maybe deceiving because the old data has different evidence from the plot I showed before, but this is projected onto a new set of parameters. So anyway. The point is that the red is below black. Okay? So more data produced more evidence for dynamics. Now, then the talk sort of moves to a different dimension, which has to do with what kind of physics could cause this. And this connects to this discussion about whether W can be less than minus one or not. And I think we agreed that for quintessence or minimally scalar field, it has to be greater than minus one. I could, then you could ask, what about scalar tensor theories? And there, you have this additional function, which can change, basically it's a modification of gravity, change the strength of gravity. And if you derive Einstein's equations, you get additional terms and this additional factor, which multiplies g. So you could actually rewrite it in this way. So you could add and subtract mu nu meta and put shove everything else and call that effective dark energy. And then if you work out what the density is for that, zero, zero component of it is that. And if you work out the pressure, you get that. So you could, again, define an effective dark energy equation of state. But this trick of solving this differential equation by taking P to be W times rho is now not always legal, because rho can easily go through zero in this kind of theories. So because, for example, you can see there is a negative sign here that can, if f changes significantly with time, that can overwhelm anything positive that you have, any other positive term. So significantly changing coupling generically leads to singularity in W. And so, therefore, for the reasons that I don't need to sell to you, a better way to do it is to reconstruct the dark energy density directly instead of working with W. And that's the plot that I showed you before. Now we use the same 2016 data, but reconstruct X, and we see this. I don't know how much detail I want to go into this, but this is how individual data sets affect this reconstruction. So again,
an alpha that pushes you to negative at large.
It's a combination of lambda and alpha, and actually H naught as well.
Because everything else is consistent with zero except the last one. So
don't forget that in this parameterization, X is defined to be one today.
So
if H naught wants to go up, you accommodate that by pushing the tail of X down. Because you, by definition, X is anchored at one. So H naught, adding H naught, where is H naught? Yeah. I mean, it does have a small effect of pushing the best fit slightly down. Can you see the white line? So it's one of the factors. But H naught actually turns out to be not the most, it's a small data point that compared to Planck. When you compare to power of Planck, H naught doesn't affect the best fit at all. And these are reconstructions with different priors, where this is, I think, the reconstruction I just showed you. And then we vary various things, like the overall strength of the prior, correlation length that you put in. Here, it's a highly constrained prior. We made delta x. It's by how much x can vary in each bin, much smaller. So you see the axes here are much different. This is from minus 2 to 2, and this is from 0.6 to 1.2 in this last one.
So this is the old Lyman alpha or new Lyman alpha?
That's a good question. I think I forgot. Could be, yeah. Oh. And then we did this evidence-weighted reconstruction, where for each prior, we calculate evidence and then weight the reconstruction, which is z. So z of z is x of z. But I don't know why it was called z in the paper. So z-weighted is x-weighted. It's the same thing. But it's weighted by this suppression factor that if your evidence is very negative, then it disfavors that particular model. And what you find is that in an evidence-weighted reconstruction, this trend of going negative disappears. I mean, it still wants to go slightly less. The Akenji wants to go to a smaller number. But essentially what this says tell us is that how much negative you go depends strongly on the prior you assume. It depends on your prior. While this feature, the oscillation, is highly independent of the prior. It just comes from BAO and supernovae, basically.
So these two are not the same scales. The one.
Yeah, because evidence-weighted reconstruction doesn't favor this change, and that's what dominates this plot. Yeah, it's different scales. It zooms in on around one.
So where is these wiggles? What redshift?
Good question. So that's not visible here. It's the same wiggles as here. Same.
What's visible? But I wasn't
sure. Okay, it's around redshift 0.5 between point three and 0.6.
So you could see the one you were showing in the last.
Yeah, it's here. So here it's. So this one is zero because it's at plus one. So it's this wiggle. So the peak.
Oh, I see. That's
peak would be at 0.2, 0.3, something like that. Okay. So there's this sort of a summary that. If you look at the improvement in chi-square, you could say it's 3.7 sigma. And if you look at Bayesian evidence, there is some positive evidence for oscillatory features. So oscillatory features seem to be quite robust, independent of your prior. But this increasing dark energy is not really that significant. So the rest, that would be a good point. And I could ask you if you want me to continue at all after this. But what I was going to talk about after this was additional. So once you go beyond the expansion history, let's say I use this example of scalar tensor theories and how we derive priors for these functions that probe connection between, that define evolution of perturbations. Horodensky theory is the effective field approach to Horodensky, and how we derive priors, so like simulate priors and then do reconstructions of not just the background history, but perturbations and history. So that was sort of the other part of the talk, but we can decide after the break if we want to talk about it. So it would be more about how you get priors in our from scalar tensor theory.